Dow and S&P in record territory, but the big story in financial markets to start the week, oil and gas futures surging to the highest level since May 2018 after a cyber attack on a key fuel line operated by Colonial Pipelines, which delivers around 45% of the fuel used on the East Coast of the United States. We also have copper jumping to a record and iron ore futures surging more than 10%. Stocks like Freeport and U.S. Steel rallying Monday morning at the open as we're talking here right now. Joining us now to discuss all this and more, David Bahnsen. He's the founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer of the Bahnsen Group, a private wealth management firm with over $2.8 billion in client assets. David, welcome to Alpha Trader.
Well, thank you for having me. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you here. So Colonial Pipeline, I confess, I'd never heard of them before this past weekend's cyber attack, but obviously they're hugely important to the energy infrastructure of the country. And in the timing is everything in life department, a mutual friend of ours reached out to me about a month ago and said, oh, you should have David on your podcast. And I said, sure. And he said, he wants to talk about pipelines. And I know you're bullish on them. Before we talk about that, what additional light, if any, can you shed on what's happening with Colonial Pipelines and the impact, the potential long-term effect it could have on energy markets?
Well, I think it's still a little early to be able to assess what some of the longer term impact will be, but there's no question it's actually, I think, being underreported in terms of how potentially impactful the story is. The focus will be, as it should be, on who did it and the motives. So the initial idea that it could have been a terrorist attack would have had one set of implications. The idea of it being a sort of environmentalist extremist group could have had another. Right now, it really looks like it was a for-profit, you know, ransom-seeking attack. And that's almost sort of undaunting to think that someone would have that capacity and that the security apparatus would allow for that level of criminality to be able to penetrate. And the fact that 3 days later, they have spot areas in which they've been able to get things back up and running, but that the main line is still down a few days later speaks to the severity of what they were able to accomplish. Prices moving higher in gasoline, heating oil, well, and crude as well. It's been reasonably muted relative to what maybe some would have thought. I think that the reality is it speaks to the need for a robust, voluminous, highly effective and technologized pipeline system to transport oil and gas in the country. Now, this one, Colonial, is privately owned. It's a consortium of owners, largely private equity oriented, some name brand private equity firms, some not. And there's some Canadian ownership in the pipeline as well. And what you see here this morning is that all of the publicly traded pipelines are bid higher, which, by the way, they're just coming off of one of the best weeks that they've had in years, coming off of one of the best quarters they've had in years. Right. So the oil and gas pipelines are in high demand right now.
Right. And again, we're talking Monday morning. And right now there's some reporting that the criminal group you referenced is called DarkSide. They're believed to have some Russian origins or somewhere in Eastern Europe. The Department of Energy is leading in federal government response. It's interagency. The White House has already waived limits on the hours truckers can drive when hauling fuel, because there's fear that the shutdown was going to push gasoline prices higher heading into the Memorial Day weekend, a big driving weekend at a time when, you know, a lot of us are getting back out into the world after getting vaccinated and some of the restrictions are being lifted. So you mentioned the pipelines, you know, getting a nice bid here this morning. Obviously, energy's been the best performing sector so far this year after being the worst performing last year. You've been bullish on energy stocks and the pipelines specifically. How does this event, if at all, change your investing thesis?
It doesn't change the thesis, but there's a number of things that are reinforced in the thesis. Let's go back to what you just said about the White House lifting the caps on on drive time for trucking as a result of this incident. What's the implication in that? It's really quite clear that where there is limited pipeline capacity, there is greater need for trucking. Okay, and that is the implication because it is true. Well, my question has always been, environmentally, do we believe it is safer for oil and gas that is required for our nation's energy infrastructure to be shipped via truck or pipeline? Another alternative that enters the fray is rail. So you have significantly less safe environmentally options in trucking and rail relative to the pipeline option. And you also have the safety aspect that was just alluded to. We have a problem with the pipeline right now, and we have to now go ask truck drivers to stay up later and longer. The reason they have the regulation to begin with about drive time for truckers is obviously there's a safety concern. The greater the pipeline use to transport oil and gas, the less strain it puts on truckers and the greater environmental safety and so forth that is available. So we have a high volume of oil and gas that is in need of being moved. And all we're debating as to how it's going to be moved. The pipelines become a far safer, more economical option. Now, the economics of it are quite simple. The way investors are paid is based on the level of volume going through the pipes. So to the extent that oil goes lower in price, to the extent that natural gas goes lower in price, it very well could increase volumes, but it certainly doesn't impact the pricing of the pipeline operator. What I believe is really important for us to understand, for those of us who care about clean energy, is that the vast majority of liquids running through these pipelines are liquefied natural gas. The ability to provide greater heating and energy needs and electricity production through natty gas versus coal has done nothing but lower carbon emissions. So it is my opinion that the environmentalist ought to be on the side of the pipelines, not opposed. But even apart from that, admittedly, sort of side issue debate, the economics of the pipelines have been atrocious over the last several years, as many companies were overly indebted, were not good stewards of either their balance sheet or their income statement. And now you've had significant economic rationalizations over the last 5 years, and the highest quality companies right now running at much less leverage, much higher ratios in terms of equity and assets. And most importantly, their income relative to debt service has skyrocketed. We like the companies that have great operating free cash flow.
Any particular names that you like here and or are along here?
Yeah, so we are extremely fond of Enterprise Product Partners. Ticker is EPD, which is essentially the largest in the country with a natural gas focus, and right neck and neck with it in size is KMI, which is Kinder Morgan. Kinder Morgan, a few years ago, un-MLP'd itself and is now a regular C Corp. EPD is still a master limited partnership, publicly traded, meaning that it provides partnership-oriented tax benefits to investors. So both, we believe, are really high-quality names that offer the type of dividend growth and distribution coverage, meaning they are not paying a dividend from their balance sheet. They're paying a distribution from cash flow and are covering the distribution 1.5 to 2 times. And so it has a lot of financial safety behind it.
And I wanted to ask you about another name that I've seen talked about in the same vein as Colonial Pipeline. That's Shell Midstream Partners. Are they an owner of that as well as the private equity firms that you mentioned?
I'm not aware of Shell Midstream being an owner, but it would not surprise me if they were a joint venture in part of it.
Okay.
They have a different business model, but I have not seen Shell Midstream listed as one of the owners. And so if they were, it would be a real minority ownership.
Okay. So it's modest to their overall business in any case. You mentioned the dividend coverage of the two players, Enterprise Product and Kinder Morgan, as being 1.5 to 2 times. What goes with, where does the rest of that cash flow, does that go back into the business to, you know, upgrading their systems or upgrading what apparently is going to be needed security for their pipelines?
So in EPD's case, they've actually done some degree of stock buybacks over the years, which has been really well done, because the stock, when it has had significant dips, they've been able to buy back stock. And of course, that lowers the cost of ongoing dividends, because they are paying out dividends to less shareholders when they buy back stock. The problem with stock buybacks to these companies is if they're overpaying when they buy back. EPD has been really smart about that. EPD, 27% of the company is owned by the founding family. This is a major, major company. You know, we're talking about a market capitalization over $50 billion. And they have grown the dividend every single quarter, even through the tough times of the last 5 years, when virtually everybody was either pausing or even reducing their distribution. So that's how disciplined they've been with their cash flow management. But to answer your question, the biggest use of excess cash above distribution to shareholders is CapEx. This is a business model, much like a REIT, a real estate investment trust, that requires ongoing investment into capital expenditures. You want more pipelines so you can have more volume. And so you're constantly looking for more opportunities with counterparties to upstream producers that need to bring their oil and gas to a downstream facility. And they contract with these midstream companies either for transportation or storage. You recall last year when there was a big glut of supply and a need, an inadequate amount of storage, the Kinders and Energy Transfers and Enterprise Products were able to come in and serve as a storage facility for a lot of these upstream producers as well. So it's a great business model when they do not get ahead of their skis financially.
And if I have a company that has $2 in free cash flow, and I take a dollar and I pay shareholders dividend, and I take 50 cents of it and I buy back stock, what is the difference in your mind between buying back stock and doing the dividend? Is it just a tax benefit to the shareholders, or is there something else going on?
Well, I think that in the case of MLPs, there's just tremendous tax benefit to the distribution. Okay. And so stock buybacks do not represent the most optimal financial source, other than the extent to which they enable a growth of distribution because of the aforementioned factor of reduced share count. But share buybacks are very minimally used with oil and gas pipelines, because distributions are the heavy way of rewarding shareholders and growth of distributions. And most excess cash flow is needed for CapEx. This is a perpetual CapEx business model, unlike, let's say, a technology company that doesn't have a lot of hard CapEx need. It's more R&D or intellectual property. But these midstream companies are constantly in need of new facilities for terminals, refiners, and so their CapEx budget does not allow them extraordinary amount of excess to go into stock buybacks. But you look at a company like EPD right now, it is at $23 a share, as we're talking on Monday morning, $23.50 to be precise. And we go back to where it was at the bottom of the COVID moment. When you see the share at $10, $11, stocks up over 100%, they were able to affect quite a bit of stock buybacks in the low teens. It stayed in the $13 range for quite some time. That was a really opportunistic use of free cash flow.
Right. So that's just good management, buying back. The buybacks are more opportunistic, as opposed to, say, banks, who for some reason tend to buy back the most stock when their stock price is the highest.
I don't think it's just banks, though. I think it's a systemic problem throughout corporate America. And my own view, if you don't mind me really pouring my soul out here, is usually it's tied to executive compensation. Most of the CEOs are paid off of an EPS formula, and they have a vested interest in reducing the share count. And I think you could point to some of the banks, but you could point to all sorts of technology companies and industrial companies that have done the exact same thing, buying back inordinate amounts of their own stock at what proved to be high levels.
Yes, Salesforce.com comes to mind when I think of that. But we do want you to bear your soul in this podcast, and that's really the subtext here. But before we do that, maybe we'll do that after the break. I feel like I should mention that I do have a position personally in Enterprise Product Partners. It's small in the grand scheme of my personal holdings and minuscule in the grand scheme of a company that size, but I feel like I should mention it. You also, and I mentioned, about a month ago, a mutual friend of ours reached out, and some of the notes he sent us was that you had recently taken a position in the USCF Midstream Energy Income Fund, with the ticker is UMI. You're still on it here. And what are your thoughts on buying in the ETF versus buying individual stocks if you're interested in this space?
Yeah. So any stock I talk about, I own, and my family owns and my firm owns. We are extraordinarily committed to skin in the game investing. And in the case of UMI, basically the largest position is EPD. It's neck and neck with another company called ENB, Enbridge, and then the already mentioned Kinder Morgan. Those three represent the three top holdings. UMI is a relatively new ETF that we were the engine behind it coming together. As you mentioned, it's distributed by USCF, sub-advised by our friends at Miller Howard, who we worked with closely to construct this. Of the roughly $80 million that has gone into the fund in the first month, $75 million of that or so is our client capital. So this is a fund that we have strong opinions on, strong conviction in. And the answer to your question as to why we like the ETF is not because we favor the concept of an ETF to individual ownership. If there was no ETF that was actively managed that could actually discriminate for quality, then I'd prefer individual stocks. But because of the burden of ownership of individual companies in this space that generate K-1s and clients and their CPAs aversion to the inconvenience of excess K-1 documents, we believe that having an ETF that does not create a K-1 gives us more operational convenience, yet I wouldn't do it unless I could have the expression and the conviction and basically the investment theses we believe in encapsulated in the ETF. So because this ETF is only right now focused on 15 to 20 companies in the space, it's diversified with MLPs, C-Corps, and even Canadian companies that all have the distribution coverage we talked about, that have the debt and asset ratios that we want, that have business models we trust, and within reason have CEOs we trust. There are CEOs in this space that have proved to be psychopaths. And we want to be able to filter to not own those companies that are leveraged monsters looking to get blown up. And right. So we like this ETF with the ticker UMI for that purpose because of its active management and the discipline that we can impose upon its holdings.
Well, I appreciate you clarifying all that because you have a vested interest in UMI literally and figuratively. And I just want to be clear, are you and your firm actively managing it, or is it someone else who's doing the
No, management? We have no economic ownership. We are simply shareholders of the fund. We get no management fees from it. But because we were the people asking them to put it together and gave them the commitment of how much money we'd put in it, we obviously had a lot of say in how it was going to come together. And we worked with the sub-advisor, which is a totally distinct company called Miller Howard Investments. They're a $3-4 billion income-oriented equity shop in Woodstock, New York. We've worked with them for many years, and we have a lot of common ground philosophically, but no economic shared interest. Our interest in UMI is simply that it became a vehicle we could conveniently own for our clients. So we own a lot of UMI, and we do own individually the other companies that I mentioned. We've owned EPD and KMI for a long time, which meant that we still have some clients that will own those and not UMI or in tandem with UMI for obvious tax reasons.
Got it.
Are EPD and KMI sizable holdings in UMI?
Yes, they are the largest.
Okay. Okay.
For conviction reasons.
Right. And before we move off of the pipelines, I do want to mention, you know, we have an obligation, I feel like, every week on this podcast to mention Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway. And they've spent a lot of money buying up pipelines.
I think CNBC is a very good company. Felt that same obligation.
Yeah. you know, they bought Dominion's natural gas pipeline assets for $9+ billion in 2020, I believe that was. So you're in good company there for sure. You know, do you think of yourself as a Graham Dodd, Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger type investor? Is that a fair statement?
No, not completely, but not unfair, because what Ben Graham's great contribution to investing is common sense and rationality, that there has to be economic rationalization to define value. Everything else is called speculation, and there can be good speculators and bad speculators, but we don't want to play word games. And so they use, as you know, a discounted cash flow model to define an intrinsic value. And it's classic Graham Dodd investing, and it's been it's been implemented by Benjamin Graham, but obviously the Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger school of thought for many, many years. But what we really focus on is dividend growth. And out of dividend growth, I think you have a lot of companies in the dividend growth universe that would be appropriate holdings at a Berkshire Hathaway. I believe there are still large holders of IBM. We are big holders of IBM. There are plenty of companies that would overlap, but the fundamental distinction would be that we're defining value off of the sustainability of growth of dividend. And so in that sense, we are very classic dividend growth investors at the Bahnsen Group. And I think a growing dividend would be one attribute they care about, but not the attribute that they care about. With Dominion Resources, though, it was just simply they're very consistent with their multi-decade philosophy of growing cash flows being discounted to a net present value and being really undervalued. So that will prove to be, in our opinion, a very tremendous investment for them.
All right, we're talking with David Bahnsen of the Bahnsen Group. We'll be right back with more Alpha Trader. Welcome back to Alpha Trader. We're continuing our conversation with David Bahnsen, Chief Investment Officer of the Bahnsen Group. It's a private wealth management firm with over $2.8 billion in assets under management. He's the author of several books, including The Case for Dividend Growth, Investing in a Post-Crisis World, which came out in 2019. So you were just talking about your focus on sustainable dividends. We talked obviously at some length about pipelines, and you mentioned IBM. Other names that you either own here, or would you be putting new money to work in based on their ability and, in your view, propensity to maintain and or raise their dividend?
So let me answer the question as to what some of the companies are that we own and why. But let me make a broader point about one of the things you just said in the question, which is, would we put new money to work in some of these names? I universally believe that for any money manager with any philosophy at any time, if they are unwilling to deploy new money, it is inexcusable for them to hold the stock. It makes no sense to say that I would hold a stock in a portfolio, but I would not buy the stock in the portfolio. It is a contradictory message that reflects tremendous lack of conviction. And because we are a growing RIA, we have no choice but to have to make a decision every single day, because we have new money coming in every single day. And our clients do not pay us to hold cash or be a parking lot for them. Either income-oriented clients want cash flow, or those who have a long-term accumulation objective are wanting us to compound their capital, and we cannot compound at a negative real rate. And that's, of course, what cash offers.
Cash, right.
And so in our opinion, the dividend growth world represents a great hedge against the issue most people are worried about when they bring up such timing-oriented concerns, which is buying in and having it go down after they buy. Because we hope everything we buy goes down after we buy, because we're going to buy more of it. And if we get to buy it at a lower price instead of a higher price, that strikes us as a good thing. And if the dividends are reinvesting, as they are for 55% of our clients, because 45% are withdrawing cash flow and 55% are not, then that means that we are buying more shares of growing income producing assets at lower prices. So we are always willing to deploy capital, but the weightings of each individual stock are a reflection of our conviction level and valuation. So right now, when I look at our holdings, it is fascinating to see how much some of these things have changed in just a few months. I mean, you could even just look at it since the election, but really just looking at it even further back since even closer since the turn of the calendar, you really see an amazing move in the weightings. We had stocks that were 3% of the portfolio that are now 4%, and we have not adjusted anything. It's just simply from their relative performance within the portfolio, not just their absolute performance, but how well they've done versus everything else. And so when you looked at the bottom of the COVID moment, those Chevrons and Exxons, enterprise product partners that we already talked about, these things were really, really beaten up. But now we've been able to generate quite a significant movement and seen a significant movement in a lot of these holdings. In terms of some of the names, we are big holders of Verizon. And Verizon is not a super exciting name, and it is only up about 3% year to date, which is actually something I like. You always want to have something you think that hasn't really moved a lot. It was up about 14% in 2019, but everything was up in 2019. But Verizon is a good size dividend payer, about 4.25%. They grow the dividend every single year like clockwork. And it is an incredibly low beta name. It's a much more stable name in the portfolio. Merck is our largest conviction pharmaceutical company. Again, it's only up about 6% year. 6% month to date. It's down a tiny bit year to date. A lot of the pharma companies are. But we believe that it also represents one of these kind of out of favor names that is a just religious dividend grower. But then you get into the really hot performers that we've experienced and in the past, you know, several months. The Chevrons and Exxons have just been unbelievable. Exxon's up 57% year to date. Simon Property is up 51% year to date. But if you look back to where things were a year ago, both names are up over 100%. So there is a good sector diversification, but it is a concentrated portfolio. We don't believe that there are 80, 60, even 40 names that fit into this universe. So we have traditionally owned 30 or less names, and we believe that that mid-20 spot is kind of the sweet spot for high-quality dividend growth.
And I wanted to see if we could turn the podcast to the Bare Your Soul section. And you've written very recently about the Japanification coming to the U.S. economy, or maybe already here. I'm a big fan of Van Hoisington and Lacey Hunt, a couple of bond fund guys, I guess, out of Texas, who for, I don't know, 30 years have been long bonds. And every time there's a kind of an inflation scare or a bond bear market scare, they put out their quarterly letter and they're like, hey, we are over indebted society, and over indebted society is a recipe for deflationary conditions going forward. We continue to be bullish long-term bonds for that reason. And your reasoning sounds very similar. We're over indebted, and that's a recipe for deflation. That certainly is how it's worked in Japan, but other countries that have become over indebted have had their bond markets literally collapse. Is it just the difference in the fact that we have a reserve currency, or Japan has a reserve currency and those other countries didn't?
Well, that's a huge factor, but it isn't the only one. The only countries that have had their bond market collapse were primitive in every category. So when you refer to the Argentinas and Venezuelas that lacked an education, Well, even in Greece's case, you had a European Union that highly complicated things. Right, I mean, right. Essentially, they had to mutualize that debt and leave the stronger northern border countries more on the hook. But I think that apart from Greece's membership in European Union, it would probably have been in worse primitive state than even some of the South American and other type countries we talk about as emerging markets. Greece peaked economically somewhere around 400 BC and went nowhere but downhill.
Downhill ever since.
I think that what you have in this story of excessive debt producing a debt deflationary spiral is highly prevalent in the European Union since the financial crisis. It is highly prevalent in the United States since the financial crisis. It's highly prevalent in the United Kingdom since before the financial crisis. And yes, Japan and the mother of them all over 30 years now. Lacey is a dear friend and economic mentor. I just spoke with him about this very subject on Friday. And what I will say is that it is not merely how right they have been, which that part confuses me. It's one thing for people to say, we think it's going to be different in the future, which is always a legitimate statement. It's not falsifiable. People could be wrong. But when those believe that it's going to be different, they at least have to acknowledge that we have had 30 years of running up excessive debt, 30 years of growing budget deficits, and 30 years of declining bond yields.
Right.
And that we can debate why that is. And maybe one can make an argument that, well, it happened in our country post-crisis for a different reason than it's happened in Japan for 30 years. I may not agree with it, but it's a legitimate thing to say. But what isn't a legitimate thing to say is that it hasn't happened. You have had if you put a chart up of UK, European Union, Japan, and United States for 40 years, you have one line going from the bottom left to the top right, which represents growing government debt. And you have one line going from the top left to the bottom right so that they form an X. They just crisscross each other, total inverse correlation.
Right.
The second line being the bond yields. So I believe that we do have deflationary traps that come as a result of government indebtedness that sucks out future economic growth from the economy.
So does that suggest that you think bond yields can go lower from here? I mean, I think there's a growing consensus that we've seen the bottom in yields, and we had that spike earlier this year, and that was just the start of something. And the 10-year's not moved much since then. It's trading around 1.6%, which means it could go down, you know, lower 160 basis points before we get to zero if we truly are like Japan. That's a yes, long-winded way of saying, like, would you be buying treasuries here?
I would not, because if the bond, everything we do has to be on a risk reward calculus, whereas Hoisington is a treasury bond manager. So they have to buy treasuries, and their question is what their duration ought to be.
Right.
Where we don't have to buy treasuries. So if I go to my clients and I say, hey, I don't really think the 1.6 is going to 3.5, but I don't know for sure that it's going to go back to 1, but it could. Well, it's true. We could make a few bucks if it went from 1.6 to 1, but the risk reward on it is totally unappealing. My clients are not going to be happy if I can get them 1% and avoid, and then point out that we didn't deteriorate capital from yields going higher. We still have to go into an upside, which makes us go up the risk curve. And so dividend growth in a highly diversified portfolio with highly sustainable dividends can get us a yield with a 4 handle and get us 6 to 9% growth per year on that income. We get no income growth from the treasuries and basically get nothing but capital preservation. So right. We have to incorporate that into client portfolios as asset allocators where appropriate, where it fits a certain client goal. But unlike my friends at Hoisington, we can't use it as a core holding in a portfolio because it's outside of our mandate for clients.
Right. Well, what is your baseline and where interest rates are going from here then? Maybe it's a better way to ask the question.
Flat to lower within a range for a decade or longer. And so that doesn't mean that cyclically, and you could look at the chart since 1980 and the mother of all bond market bulls of all time, going from 15% to 1% on the 10-year, still had multiple periods of multiple hundred basis point moves higher. So it's entirely possible that between now and 2030, there are different 10-year yields that will spike higher. I don't happen to think they're going to be able to spike to a three handle, but you know, do we get a two handle in the 10-year along the way? I think it's entirely possible. But no, I think that the secular trend, which is what we concern ourselves with, we're incredibly aligned with Lacey Hunt on this. I think that the secular trend for bond yields is A, that they won't go higher, but B, they can't. Now, one of the reasons I don't think we're going to see negative yields, despite everything I'm saying, is that I do think we will have enough nominal growth to avoid that. That our demographics, our technology, our R&D, there is still a productivity that makes us better than Japan. It just makes us not as good as we used to be. Right. And I don't like that. And I think it's immoral.
Like that either. Yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought it back to Japan. And Stephen mentioned the Japanification that you've been writing about and talking about. You mentioned demographics, and you know there was some data out recently showing that U.S. that we're having a baby bust in this country, right? And isn't that really, at the end of the day, the biggest threat to economic growth is a declining population, an aging population? And how do, you know, what is the quote unquote, the answer that we can't compel people to have more babies, but that's been a real problem for Japan and Russia and other aging economies.
Yeah. And if you remember, Japan's problem with no babies began in the mid 90s, meaning they hadn't been having any babies in the 70s or 80s, because then they got to the 90s and their aging population began dying off at a higher rate than new people were entering adulthood. And it just has continued for the last 20 years. So they had a generational and cultural buildup. And we are experiencing the same, really kind of since the financial crisis on the margins. Our 2.1 began climbing down, and now we're sitting there at the 1.8 or so. We'll have to see how transitory some of the dip recently around the COVID year proved to be. But I could make an argument that some would have thought the number may go higher out of COVID. We'll have to see. But look, I think that the truth of the matter is that those trends are not good in the United States, but they are not decelerating at the rate they have in Japan. But that's the most optimistic thing I could say, is that our Japanification may Japanify at a slower pace than theirs did. But I don't have an intellectual argument to make that we will avoid Japanification. It is not merely, though, I think you may have asked if the population or demographic issue was the largest concern. I view this as a tautology: economic growth equals population growth plus productivity growth. I am just as concerned about our declining productivity that is segregated from the population problem. A less productive society because of less CapEx and less business investment. And we've had bare minimum business investment since the financial crisis. It spiked up in 2017 behind Trump tax cuts, deregulation, an increase in business optimism. It came back down around the trade war of 2018. It was running again in 2019. COVID is sort of a mulligan of a year, and post-COVID is sort of a mulligan of a year. I'm not excited about a pickup in CapEx now because I take it to be a response to the collapse of CapEx from last year. But are we going to see a new spike in business investment that can maintain and grow the low levels of productivity that we're experiencing when we have a Fed that is enabling such a high degree of zombie companies? I'm skeptical of it. Right. I hope and pray that I'm wrong. And there are always things in the American economic system that can surprise us to the upside. That's a bullish but realistic view of our dynamism. And yet, structurally, The sub trend line growth we have struggled through. Keep in mind, even the great year that people will brag about in 2017, where we got up to 3% real GDP growth, even that was a whisker below the 3.1% trend line GDP growth that we've had on average for 60 years. So in my opinion, the high buildup of monetary and fiscal that we have relied upon since the great financial crisis is going to constrain our real GDP growth, our productivity. You add in the population demographic concerns and you get, voila, Japanification.
And I'm glad you brought the Fed up, because I wanted to ask, is there anything the Fed could do to shake you out of that secular belief in continuing long-term decline in long-term interest rates? We're experiencing an economic boom right now. Prices of everything, from commodities to prices at the pump to at my grocery store, are significantly higher. There are job shortages everywhere. I've spoken to a variety of business leaders, at least in my hood. They literally cannot find workers. And the Fed is very clear that they're on hold until 2023, which is more than a year and a half away. I mean, could they be easy for long enough to actually maybe shake this secular decline in long-term rates?
There's, of course, there's something the Fed could do. And it's absolutely the one thing they're not going to do, is the Fed could come out and say, there's nothing we can do, that bond buying is doing nothing for the fact that there are people getting paid to not go get a job. The problem is that the society has accepted that the Fed has not only a responsibility that they don't have, but an ability that they don't have. The Fed cannot create loan demand. The Fed cannot create job stimulation out of there being openings and growing average hourly wages and growing hours worked, and yet a record number of people not able to fill those jobs. That's entirely on the fiscal and policy side. And so the only thing the Fed could do if they want to get the long yield higher is announce or use forward guidance to tell the market that they're not going to continue to artificially constrain the long bond. The long bond, left to its own devices, would trade at the Fed funds plus nominal GDP growth expectations. The Fed funds is at zero, so the Fed bears responsibility for that. But nominal GDP growth expectations are way too low. And they're too low because of a debt deflationary spiral that we find ourselves in. The whole thing, though, honestly, is hypothetical. The Fed can't do what they could do because the federal government needs them to quasi-monetize their own debt.
We in the financial press, we seem to hyperventilate every time someone from the Fed comes out and speak. And we have more Fed speakers this week. Lionel Brainard speaking, and Chicago Fed president, I'm blanking on his name, I'm sorry, is speaking as well. We hyperventilate, but we don't know their names. But as a money manager, as an investor, given your point of view about the Fed, do you care about this stuff? Do you pay attention? When Jay Powell, for example, speaks, I know who he is.
Yeah. You know, I pay attention to all of it, but I pay attention to all of it to use it as anecdotal support for our thesis that the Fed has become a coddler of risk assets, and it's not going to change.
Right.
There is no chance I'm ever going to listen to the Fed and they're going to say something that's going to surprise me again in my lifetime. It will not happen.
Right.
Okay. Well, right. So the Fed saying things that are really, I'm not criticizing them, by the way. I don't think they have a choice. But when they say things that mean nothing, like we're watching the data and we believe right now it is still appropriate to stay very accommodative, and at the right time, we intend to act to reverse that accommodation whenever that becomes necessary. Now, those two statements mean nothing. There's no specificity. There's no timeline. There's no action. Look at the dot plots of the Fed's expectations of rates coming out of financial crisis versus the Fed funds futures. They were wrong every single year.
Yes.
And so when people are saying like, oh, they're going to stay low till 2023, I'll take the over. I think it could be 2026, 27, based on history. Right. Now, so, maybe it won't this time, because I think the Fed does know that they need to get themselves some policy tool for next time we inevitably have a COVID, a 9/11, a financial crisis, a credit crisis. There's going to be some economic emergency, and they're not going to have any bullets in the gun. But the fact of the matter is that we are living in a period of unprecedented monetary experimentation, and the Fed has not yet come close to hitting a ceiling on what they're willing to try. They're emboldened by the fact that they've thrown the kitchen sink at different things, and it hasn't really gone wrong. The world hasn't ended. So I think that we're just going to have to sit back and accept that there's a lot of experimentation. I don't really think it's a great thing for the society and for central bank independence that we create little mini celebrities out of these people. I don't think Jay Powell plays into that quite the way Alan Greenspan did. Greenspan was an insufferable prima donna.
Yes, he was.
But the truth of the matter is that Lil Brennard is campaigning for the job, and she's probably going to get it. And so some of these governors that speak more than others that aren't named Jay Powell, they have their own vertical mobility. And, you know, what are you going to do?
Right. So for the record, Chicago Fed president is Charles Evans. No disrespect to Mr. Evans.
And by the way, he is not campaigning to be a celebrity for anything.
Right. Exactly. The Chicago guys do things a little differently. Before we wrap in, this has been the soul searching or revealing portion of the podcast. And we appreciate that along with the stock picking, for sure. You referenced this, but you wrote recently that, quote, "I have to believe an even bigger shock and awe from the Fed awaits us in the future."
Sure.
And, quote, what, when you use your imagination and when you write that, what are you thinking may or could occur?
Well, part of it is that I'm not thinking what could occur, because the point I'm making is unforeseeable creativity. Okay. I could not have sat back in 2007 and said, hey, next time we have a crisis, they're going to create a facility where Congress puts a little bit of fake equity in, and then they're going to go create a SPV to lever the hell out of buying distressed mortgage assets and call it non-risk loss absorbing, and end up making $40 billion on the Bear Stearns Maiden Lane portfolio or the term asset-backed loan facility that we called TALF, where they were buying non-agency RMBS and CMBS and syndicated loans. Okay, that was an incredible amount of creativity to skirt around the Emergency Act provisions of the Fed. And they did it. And I guess, you know, I mean, it technically was legal because they said it was legal. I don't think it's within the spirit of the law, but I'm not a lawyer on this stuff. My point is, that was a level of creativity that I would have never been able to foresee. And they did it. And in hindsight, I can now analyze it and talk about it, and we can have a conversation about it. The most obvious thing in the future, as long as they stay limited by the current congressional standard, okay, Congress is going to have to amend the Federal Reserve Act for them to go full Japan. They can't buy stocks, for example. Now, they found a way to buy high-yield bonds, okay? Yep. So never say never. They were buying actual high-yield bond ETFs a year ago. I most certainly could not have seen that coming. But the thing, I guess, is probably lowest hanging fruit is printing a $1 trillion bill and buying it and leaving it on deposit. So it's not really monetizing the debt. It just lingers out there in outer space. It is obviously quasi debt monetization, but it would not be the same because they couldn't erase it. It would still be an asset and liability in dual accounting. It would stay as an asset on the Fed balance sheet and a liability on Treasury. They only own what, about 20% of the United States Treasury bond market. Japan owns well over 60% of theirs. So they have plenty of room to go before they get to crazy stuff like that. But do I expect they're going to own a higher percentage of our bond market in the future? Oh, you're damn right I do. Absolutely.
Right. And just to be clear, before we wrap, we appreciate all your time here this morning. But all these things we're discussing, whether you like them or not, or agree with them or not, philosophically, are, at the end of the day, generally good for risk assets, correct? It's good for people who are long stocks and cryptocurrencies probably as well.
I don't think that's true about crypto, but we'll save that conversation for another day. I don't think there's any basis for saying it's good or bad for crypto, because I don't accept the thesis that crypto trades off of monetary insanity. I think it trades off of speculative euphoria. But I do believe that to the extent the category of things we've talked about so far, prime liquidity in the financial system and serve to boost the multiple of risk assets by constricting the risk-free rate. So it just becomes a mathematical, it's an algebraic formula. Then yes, I think they are good for risk assets. Yet that doesn't take into account what other bad could come down the line that could become very problematic for risk assets. So the precedent of the financial crisis and the precedent of .com, albeit with much more moderate monetary tools that were allowing accommodation, they were very good for risk assets, but they exacerbated a boom bust cycle. And the bust in both cases was not good for risk assets.
Right.
So I don't have any reason to believe this will end differently. I think the Fed has consciously accepted as a necessary part of, as a necessary side effect of their policy objectives, the exacerbation of boom bust cycles.
I agree. And we will have to save it for another time, but I would argue that monetary insanity, as you put it, is driving the speculative mania in cryptos. So there is a connection.
Well, get 100 people in a room that own crypto and get 90 of them to explain to you what you just said. And I think they'll change your mind real quick. Or to spell all right. Monetary.
All right. Our guest has been David Bahnsen, Chief Investment Officer of the Bahnsen Group. He's author of several books and also the host of National Review's Capital Matters podcast. You can listen to that and hear much more about his views on the world. David, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, guys. I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, David.